We're in the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha, the word means what? Hidden away, hidden things. It does not mean false, although that's the way you hear the word apocryphal or apocrypha used a lot. But that's more from anti-Catholic sentiments than it is the actual meaning of the word. The Apocrypha, we talked about the different genres you find in the Apocrypha. Historical books, some of the romantic books, wisdom or didactic books. I actually think I'm going to make my kids, whenever we get to about 10 or 11, we're going to go through Proverbs to start talking about wisdom, but we're going to go through Sirach. Sirach's incredible. The amount of just some really conventional, down, ground-level wisdom that it gives you is fantastic. Something that I really want my kids to listen to. Moralistic books, Baruch, Epistle of Jeremiah, we went through those yesterday. But I want to talk about the importance of the Apocrypha for the New Testament by giving you three examples of the way in which the Apocrypha intersects with the New Testament. We're going to look at the way it intersects on genres so that it actually helps us understand certain genres in the New Testament that are foreign to us. We'll talk about the way it interacts with some of their society as stories that make up who they are. And we'll actually, there's some details in our New Testament that we don't get answers in the Old Testament, but the answers come in the Apocrypha. The first one, though, is the genre help of understanding the book of Revelation. In my Revelation class, we're going to be going over this as well. But 2nd Esdras, which is in the Apocrypha, and part of it is in the Pseudepigrapha as well, 4th Ezra. 4th Ezra, this is something that you may want to just know for food for thought. 4th Ezra equals chapters 3 through 12 of 2nd Esdras. So we will see 4th Ezra in the Pseudepigrapha. This is in the Apocrypha. So technically this contains this, even though it's in a separate one. You have some weird conflations like that between the two lists. But this comes from 2nd Esdras 11, 1 through 6. And I'm going to read the first one, the first part of it, which is the description of this vision. I want you guys to give an interpretation of what you think is happening in the vision, and then I'll read the interpretation from 2nd Esdras itself. Okay? So listen to this. On the second night I had a dream, and behold, there came up from the sea an eagle that had 12 feathered wings and 3 heads. And I looked, and behold, he spread his wings over all the earth, and all the winds of heaven blew upon him, and the clouds were gathered about him. And I looked, and out of his wings there growing opposing wings, but they became little puny wings. But his heads were at rest. The middle head was larger than the other heads, but it also was at rest with them. And I looked, and behold, the eagle flew with his wings to reign over the earth and over those who dwell in it. And I saw how all things under heaven were subjected to him, and no one spoke against him, not even one creature that was on the earth. What are we describing? Rome. First of all, what genre is this? Apocalyptic. Apocalyptic. One of the reasons why we jack up Revelation so bad is because we don't read the Apocrypha. And we don't read Daniel. We don't realize this is not a foreign genre. This was a very common one. One they would have been very used to interacting with. In Revelation 13, you have a beast coming out of the sea. Just like Revelation chapter 7, you have 4 beasts coming out of the sea. Here in 2nd Esdras chapter 11, we have a beast coming out of the sea. But what is this beast? What is it described as? An eagle, which is the key symbol of Rome. And this eagle is the one, it starts talking about the different size of the head. The largest one would have been referring to Augustus or Octavian. Even though he was at rest with the rest of them, he was the one that was more influential than all of them. And yet this beast that these heads were a part of were the ones that the whole world was subjected to. You seeing what's happening? This is a very common genre. Let's go ahead and just interpret what it says here. This actually, this interpretation is pretty interesting. This is written about 100, concurrent, simultaneous with the book of Revelation, by the way. Same time period. It's kind of like, in Hollywood, they go through phases where certain types, like right now, the superhero genre has been going crazy for like the past 5 to 7 years. Same thing with written literature. Sometimes you have written literature, like vampire and written literature right now is just surging still, which is baffles my mind, but whatever. And same thing here. Apocalyptic literature has a time frame in which it's exploding. But in chapter 12, 10 through 16, the angel says to Ezra this is the interpretation of this vision which you have seen. The eagle which you saw coming up from the sea is the fourth kingdom which appeared in a vision to your brother Daniel. I actually find that pretty interesting because we have a ton of people that interpret the book of Daniel and they look at the fourth kingdom as Greece because they're trying to, I think, unnecessarily force it into the second century. But I find it pretty interesting that a document in 100 says, no, the fourth kingdom of Daniel is actually Rome. So, I mean, we can pontificate all we want, 2,000 years removed, but why don't you just go 100 years removed and see what they're interpreting. He says, this is the fourth kingdom which appeared to your brother Daniel. But it was not explained to him as I now explain or have explained it to you. Behold, the days are coming when a kingdom shall arise on earth, and it shall be more terrifying than all the kingdoms that have been before it. And 12 kings shall reign in it, one after another. Anybody know that the title of Suetonius's, one of his most famous books? The Lives of the 12 Emperors. Yeah, the 12 Caesars. There will be 12 kings that shall reign in it, one after another. But the second that is to reign shall hold sway for a longer than any of the other 12. And that's true. Octavian, which was the second king after Julius Caesar, which was the first emperor, in Suetonius' writings, he was longer than all of them. This is the interpretation of the 12 wings, which you saw. What do you notice? What do you notice here? How does this apocryphal book help us understand the New Testament?
It gives us
a referent point. If we can see how Jews are interacting with images and other documents, it can help inform us of how to interact with images in our own documents. What else?
It really lays out the Jewish expectations for what is about to happen. If they really believe that the fourth kingdom is reigning, in the middle of reigning, then they really think that the Messianic kingdom is right around the corner.
Yeah, absolutely. Second Esdras, right at 30 years after Second Esdras is whenever Bar Kokhba comes on the scene. The last messianic figure, at the coercion of Akiba to actually try and lead a bloody revolution. Yeah, this is their general feel at the end of the first century. They don't believe that just because they lost in 66 to 73, that their violent revolution still can't happen. And Second Esdras is some of that kind of driving feel. What else? Yeah, part of the apocalyptic driving for the Jews in this time period is we have one last-ditch effort, and we think that's when it will succeed. Yeah, they are. They're struggling with their identity, because not only has Christianity moved away and Hellenization may be seeping in more, but you also have the lack of a temple, which is their key identity. I mean, they are struggling with who they are at the end of the first century, and we get to look into this. You also get to see that what has been tracing, that will have been tracing for really since the exile all the way on, is still there. It's this anti-imperial sentiment. This desire, the Jews did not just desire for the superpowers to be eradicated. They desired to be ruling in their place. Big difference. And that's what he's describing here in this image. Is this beast coming? But trust me, the judgment day is coming for it whenever, eventually, you guys will be in the positions of the oppressors. Good. All right, another example. This one's a little bit more, well, I shouldn't say obvious. But turn to Mark chapter 12. This one, I'm trying to stay away from my examples from the Gospels because you guys will have to be doing that a lot. But this one's just too good to pass over. Mark chapter 12. At least I think it's good. But Mark chapter 12, verse 18. Through 23, at this point in the ministry of Jesus, he's already had the triumphal entry in chapter 11. He's already cleansed the temple in chapter 11. He's already told the parable of the tenants, which was against the Jewish elite, in chapter 12. And they launched their first attack against Jesus in verse 13. The Pharisees come along and they say, should we pay taxes to Caesar? And Jesus says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's. Actually, we'll talk about, I think in 4 weeks, the Gospel of Thomas has that exact same thing in there, but it adds a portion. And give to me what is mine, Jesus says in the Gospel of Thomas, which is pretty interesting. We'll get to that later. Where we're at, though, is verse 18, where the Sadducees come and they say, you Pharisees may have failed, but we won't. And the Sadducees, they attack one of the key things that they find is foolish from the Pharisees' teaching. The same thing that they will be fighting over in the book of Acts whenever Paul's on trial, the resurrection. So the Sadducees, verse 18, then the Sadducees who say there is no resurrection, thank you, Mark, notice how the author, the narrator, is interacting with us literarily there in that aside. That's the stuff you're going to be paying attention to in your literary analysis eventually, okay? Because right there, that's a total aside. That's really, he's making sure we understand the issue. Then the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him with a question. Teacher, they said, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife but no children, the man must marry the widow and have children for his brother. That's true. That comes from Deuteronomy chapter 25. It's called Levirate marriage. The whole idea was if your brother dies and doesn't have any children, then in order to preserve your brother's honor and to make sure that your brother's name is not blotted out of the annals of history because he doesn't have any children, then you are to marry your brother's wife, and the first son that he has will belong to your brother. We will carry your brother's name. So it's preserving the honor, preserving the name so that it's not blotted out of history. He says, that's what Moses tells us, Deuteronomy 25. Now, verse 20. Now there were seven brothers. The first one married and died without leaving any children. The second one married the widow, but he also died, leaving no child. It was the same with the third. In fact, none of the seven left any children. Last of all, the woman died too. At the resurrection, whose wife will she be, since the seven were married to her? Now, I might give a full interpretation of this. Depends on how much I feel like. You can hear this not just in a debate between the Sadducees and Jesus, but you can hear this same accusation being thrown between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Pharisees are talking about a resurrection, and the Sadducees say, we've got this riddle that you cannot come to some sort of conclusion. What do you do when a woman marries a man? Seven men. They're all brothers, Levirate marriage. She marries all of them. But they all die. There's two things that we know about this woman at this point. Number one, she is barren. And if she is barren, she is shameful. As a matter of fact, a lot of the Jewish literature, but as well as even Greco-Roman, a woman was considered a stranger in her own household until she bore a child. Because she had no worth if she was not bearing children. Sorry, I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm just saying the way it was. But the second thing you know is that this woman is not just barren. She is cursed. Completely cursed. Why do I say that? Seven. It's not an accidental number. Seven is a number of completion. And this woman, in their riddle, in their story, seven times over, she is married. And it does not end up working out. They die. She is a cursed woman who is barren, and she must be completely cursed. Otherwise, it wouldn't have happened seven times. It almost seems like the Sadducees just pulled this out of nowhere. But if you know your Apocrypha, you know exactly where this comes from. Where does it come from? Anybody know the story or the name of the book? Because this is the exact story you find in the book of Tobit. The exact story. They don't just pull it out of nowhere. They don't just say, let me make something up. They say, let's take a common story of our people and let me take this common story and show you why this disproves the resurrection. Because how are you going to explain this riddle? What happens in the book of Tobit? Well, there's a woman named Sarah, who has seven husbands she's legally married to, but is never able to consummate the marriage because on the wedding night, the demon Asmodeus comes and abducts the husband and kills him. Seven times this happens to this woman. Now, what the Sadducees change from the story is the woman in Tobit does not die before there's an answer. She lives. As a matter of fact, there's a guy named Tobias, no relation to the Arrested Development character. A man named Tobias, though, is walking on his way to Media. And the angel Raphael comes, and as it disguised as a companion, just tells him about his cousin Sarah and the shame that's going to be brought on their family and how he can fix it. So through at one point, this giant, and you'll read this, but this giant fish comes to attack Tobit. And instead of it killing him or hurting him, he's able to actually kill the fish. And Raphael says, now use the entrails of this fish. And on the night of the marriage with Sarah, you burn the entrails of the fish and it will keep the demon Asmodeus away. And that's exactly what happens. Point is this. This doesn't come out of nowhere. This is a common story of the Jewish people that the Sadducees were using, not just against Jesus, but more than likely against the Pharisees as well, to show that the concept of the resurrection doesn't even make sense within our own tradition. It doesn't make any sense. Because how are you going to divvy that one out? And Jesus gives him an answer. And notice, though, well, I won't get into the full explanation of this, but Jesus' answer is targeting not so much what we will be like in heaven when we're married, although that's how we abuse this passage all the time. His answer is targeting the legitimacy of the resurrection. Okay, you want to know my honest opinion of what Jesus says here? I was talking to some guys the other night. They were asking me this question that most of the time guys ask, and I apologize, but it's just the way guys are. Will there be sex in heaven? And their anxiety about that comes from this passage. And I said, no, you have to. We make the passage say that, but you have to understand what marriage even meant then. They weren't asking which one gets to be with this woman in heaven at the resurrection. They don't even believe in the resurrection. Women in the ancient world were property. They were liabilities, especially if they're barren and cursed. To where even if she's providing nothing for you, you still had to provide for her. And what the Sadducees are asking is not, will there be sex in heaven? The Sadducees are asking, who gets stuck with her in the afterlife? Whose problem is she in the afterlife? And Jesus' response is, everyone's provided by God. God takes care of everyone. Don't you understand that it's just like the angels? God takes care of all of them. He will take care of all of you. We look at marriage through the lens of love and intimacy. They look at marriage through contractual obligations that add honor or take away honor from their people. Big difference. So we need to make sure whenever we understand what question they're asking, we need to know where it comes from. We also need to understand what they're actually asking before we come up with a ridiculous theological. I have literally heard someone say before, this passage teaches that in heaven, I will have access to your wife as much as you do right now. And that's just ridiculous. That is not what Jesus is saying. That's ridiculous. That distorts Jesus. Why? Part of it's because we just don't know the background story from the Apocrypha. Is this making sense? The Apocrypha intersects with the New Testament all the time. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 35. I love this one. This one's really cool. Actually, we'll be going back to Hebrews 11 a couple times. So once you turn there, just keep your finger there because we'll go back there with the pseudepigrapha as well. Hebrews chapter 11, 35. What is Hebrews chapter 11? Faith Hall of Fame, is it not? We're going from one person to another about their incredible faith. By faith, Abel, verse 4, offered God a better sacrifice than Cain did. And you go down, verse 5. By faith, Enoch, who is a major figure in pseudepigraphical works. First Enoch parallels Revelation almost more than any other book in the Apocrypha or pseudepigrapha. First Enoch 1:9, which we will read in just a little bit, is quoted directly in Jude. Directly, and we'll talk about the hermeneutical significance of that in a bit. But the Faith Hall of Fame, and they're going down and they're naming all these people that we're very familiar with. We could do the same exercise here that we did with the genealogy in Matthew's Gospel and find a similar impact. There is a greater story, a story of faith that is being woven into the first century Christians. This is what they are a part of. But there are some we don't recognize. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 35 says this. Actually, let me go back to verse 32, just so we can get a running start at this, because the names that are in verse 32, you'd think by the time we get to 35, we were climaxing towards names we really knew. And what more shall I say, the Hebrew author writes. I do not have time to tell about Gideon or Barak or Samson or Jephthah or David or Samuel and the prophets who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, that's a big one, and gained what was promised. Who shut the mouths of the lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and became powerful in battle, and routed foreign armies. Now listen to verse 35. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. Huh. Keep that phrase in your mind. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured and refused to be released, so that they might gain a better resurrection. What was the driving force of these examples here? The afterlife. The resurrection. Now let's read 2 Maccabees, chapter 7. Oh, I just closed my Bible in Hebrews. I told you to keep it open there, but I didn't. I'm actually going to read chapter 7, verses 1 through 41, and here's the reason why. I read this the other day, and it was one of those, there are certain times whenever you're reading things and you don't expect it, and you have this deeply devotional moment. And that's what happened to me in this one. This same thing happened to me. If you want to have a good devotional reading, read the Martyrdom of Polycarp in the Apostolic Fathers. It will just rock you. And this one's on par with that for me. 2 Maccabees 7, 1 through 41. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. Whenever we'll be talking about this in a couple of weeks, when he's ransacking Judea with the Greek, the Hellenization, and he's making them sacrifice swine on altars, and he's doing incredibly atrocious things. It says, it happened also that seven brothers, notice the number, that seven brothers and their mother were arrested and were being compelled by the king, by Antiochus, under torture with whips and cords, to partake of unlawful swine's flesh. One of them, acting as their spokesman, said, what do you intend to ask and learn from us? For we are ready to die rather than transgress the laws of our fathers. The king fell into a rage, and he gave orders that pans and cauldrons be heated. These were heated immediately, and he commanded that the tongue of their spokesman be cut out, and that they scalp him and cut off his hands and feet, while the rest of the brothers and the mother looked on. When he was utterly helpless, the king ordered them to take him to the fire, still breathing, and to fry him in a pan. The smoke from the pan spread widely, but the brothers and their mother encouraged one another to die nobly, saying, the Lord God is watching over us, and in truth has compassion on us, as Moses declared in his song, which bore witness against the people to their faces, when he said, and he will have compassion on his servants. After the first brother had died in this way, they brought forward the second for their sport. They tore off the skin of his head with the hair and asked him, will you eat rather than have your body punished limb by limb? He replied in the language of his fathers. That's a very important thing. Matter of fact, one of the ways in which people fight back against empires is they either refuse to speak the imperial language, or they twist the imperial language into almost an alternative language inside the language, which is the origin of rap as a whole. The whole concept of rap is a protest against the people that are oppressing them. And the way they're protesting is they're actually lyrically and poetically using the language in a better way than what the imperialists are using it themselves. It's one of the reasons why a lot of times on the plantations, it's not that the African Americans were ignorant and that's why they spoke different. Part of it was a protest against those that were making them speak a language that was not their own. It's the same reason why Revelation, I think, consistently has grammatical mistakes all throughout the document. It's a document that's writing against some of the imperial oppression. And one of the ways you can fight against the empire is through language. So, for example, even in modern day, we were talking, I think Adam and I were talking about this, or maybe I was reading this, I don't remember. But in the Serbian and the Croatian, conflict, they would start any words that they would find have conjugated that could be traced back to their enemy's language. They would come in and have a whole new word be put in its place, because they were making a statement, a protest against those they were fighting, their enemies. And the way they were doing it was through language. So here, the person speaks, the one being persecuted speaks, but he replies using the language of his fathers. And he said to them, no. Therefore, he in turn underwent tortures as the first brother had done. And when he was at his last breath, he said, listen to this, you accursed wretch, you dismiss us from this present life, but the King of the universe will raise us up to an everlasting renewal of life. Remember what Hebrews 11:35 says? Why were they willing to die? What was their driving motivation? Resurrection. He says, but the King of the universe will raise us up to an everlasting life, a renewal of life, because we have died for his laws. After him, the third was the victim of their sport. When it was demanded, he quickly put out his tongue and courageously stretched forth his hands and said nobly, I got these from heaven, and because of his laws I disdained them. And from him I hope to get them back once again. As a result, the king himself and those with him were astonished at the young man's spirit, for he regarded his sufferings as nothing. When he too had died, they maltreated and tortured the fourth in the same way. And when he was near death, he said, "One cannot but choose to die at the hands of men to cherish the hope that God gives us of being raised again by him. But for you, there will be no resurrection to life." Next, they brought forward the fifth and maltreated him. But he looked at the king and said, "Because you have authority among men, mortal though you are, you do what you please. But do not think that God has forsaken our people. Keep on and see how his mighty power will torture you and your descendants." After him, they brought forward the sixth. And when he was about to die, he said, "Do not deceive yourself in vain. For we are suffering these things on our own account because of our sins against our own God. Therefore, astounding things have happened, but do not think that you will go unpunished for having tried to fight against God." The mother was especially admirable and worthy of honorable memory. That's why she makes it into the Faith Hall of Fame. "Though she saw her seven sons perish within a single day, she bore it with good courage because of her hope in the Lord. She encouraged each of them in the language of their fathers, in the language of their fathers. Filled with the noble spirit, she fired her woman's reasoning with a man's courage and said to them, 'I do not know how you came into being in my womb. It was not I who gave you life and breath, nor I who set in order the elements within each of you. Therefore, the Creator of the world, who shaped the beginning of man and devised the origin of all things, will in his mercy give life and breath back to you again," resurrection, "since you now forget yourselves for the sake of his laws." Antiochus felt that he was being treated with contempt, and he was suspicious of her reproachful tone. The youngest brother being still alive, Antiochus not only appealed to him in words, but promised with oaths that he would make him rich and enviable if he would just turn away from the ways of his fathers, and that he would take him for his friend and entrust him with public affairs. Since the young man would not listen to him at all, the king called the mother to him and urged her to advise the youth to save himself. After much urging on his part, she undertook to persuade her son. But leaning close to him, she spoke in their native tongue as follows, deriding the cruel tyrant, "My son, have pity on me. I carried you 9 months in my womb and nursed you for 3 years and have reared you and brought you up to this point in your life and have taken care of you. I beseech you, my child, my son, to look at the heaven and the earth and see everything that is in them and recognize that God did not make them out of things that even existed. Thus also mankind comes into being. Do not fear this butcher, but prove worthy of your brothers. Accept death so that in God's mercy I may get you back again with your brothers." Same phrase in Hebrews 11:35. While she was still speaking, the young man said, "What are you waiting for? I will not obey the king's command, but I obey the command of the law that was given to our fathers through Moses. But you who have contrived all sorts of evil against the Hebrews will certainly not escape the hands of God. For we are suffering because of our own sins. And if our living Lord is angry for a little while to rebuke and discipline us, he will again be reconciled with his own servants. But you, unholy wretch, you most defiled of all men, do not be elated in vain and puffed up by uncertain hopes when you raise your hand against the children of heaven. You have not yet escaped the judgment of the Almighty, all-seeing God. For our brothers, after enduring a brief suffering, have drunk of ever-flowing life under God's covenant. But you, by the judgment of God, will receive just punishment for your arrogance. I, like my brothers, give up my body and life for the laws of our fathers, appealing to God to show mercy soon to our nation, and by afflictions and plagues to make you confess that he alone is God. And through me and my brothers," that's actually a really huge phrase, by the way. You know what the word Epiphanes even means attached to the end of Antiochus' name? God manifest. "These plagues to make you confess that he alone is God. And through me and my brothers to bring to an end the wrath of the Almighty which has justly fallen on our whole nation." The king fell into a rage and handled him worse than the others, being exasperated at his scorn. So he died in his integrity, putting his whole trust in the Lord. And last of all, the mother died after her sons. If they don't make it into the Faith Hall of Fame, I don't know who does. You see what the Hebrews author is saying? More than anything, what the Faith Hall of Fame is all about is not just a list of people that attaches to a good story, but all stories are intended to guide the way we act in the present. They're intended to elicit an ethic. And if you don't know the stories that are even put in there, then it's going to be hard for you to emulate the same ethic. Is this making sense? Why? Reflect with me for a bit. We've been asking this question, why is this study important? Now, having gone through a couple of examples, just reflect with me what you're thinking, what's going through your mind. Maybe stuff's bothering you about what we're talking about. Maybe it's exciting you.
I guess the only issue I have, like, I don't necessarily have an issue, but the question is like how much importance then should we give to the Apocrypha if this is the importance that the writers gave to them?
Yeah, whenever you start to realize the way it intersects, you almost sit there and go, yeah, I can kind of understand why the Catholics do what they did. I mean, we usually ridicule them and scorn them because we find this in their canon. You bunch of idiots, what are you adding stuff to the canon for? There's no reason for that. Because these are the stories that make up a lot of the background that inform us what our canon's even talking about. And they seem to value him. Didn't they? I mean, why does... Jesus wasn't shocked when he heard the Sadducees bring up the story of the seven. He probably would have said, oh, I know what you're talking about. It's the book of Tobit. It's not like these apocryphal books were something that were infused with some sort of disease that if you touch them or read them, then it's going to lead you astray. Don't get me wrong. There are some things in there that we don't agree with. Because a lot of it's not infused with the full revelation of what Jesus brings. For example, one of the things they talk about in the Apocrypha a lot when it's attached to the resurrection is that there won't be a dual resurrection. They're still very much influenced by the Jewish understanding that the good are the ones resurrected to a separate world that is not a part of the abode of God. And that's why he says, I will be resurrected to life, but you will not see a resurrection. Well, John chapter 5, Revelation chapter 20 disagrees with that. And that's okay. It's kind of one of the things where when there is a disagreement, what are you going to opt for? The New Testament books. That's the reason why I'm okay with us keeping our canon. I'm not going to fight for us to add in these apocryphal books. What I am going to fight for is for us to stop being so ignorant of them. Because it only hurts us. We understand Hebrews better. When we realize that we're going to be hanging out with these people when we get to our resurrected life. How could I say such a thing? Because we'll be hanging out with Moses too, and he didn't know Jesus. He was just obeying God in the faith that he knew at that time, right? Isn't that what Romans is all about with Abraham? He's credited his righteousness, his faith was credited to him as righteousness. What is their faith credited to them as? That's what Hebrews 11 is all about. It's not understanding everything about the mystery of God, but it's about obeying what God has revealed to you in the time in which He calls you to obey. And that's why I think it's very appropriate to have 2 Maccabees chapter 7, verses 1 through 41 as a part of our Faith Hall of Fame, something that we should meditate on and pass on to our children, which is what the Hebrews author was attempting to do. Does this not make any sense? What else is going through your mind? What else are you reflecting on?
I have a tendency to use way more redaction, sort of criticism, and a lens of looking at these apocryphal books, and then to see how the New Testament writers are using them. That's sort of very much how they use the Old Testament. Which kind of throws me for a loop as far as what do I put this literature? How do I treat it? If it looks a lot like the New Testament in a lot of ways, what does that do to my whole view of everything?
Yeah, and that's a good thing for you to wrestle with. It's a good thing for you to wrestle with. You hear his struggle on that? Maybe one of the things I don't want you to hear me that I'm anti-historical grammatical, because I'm not. As a matter of fact, that's how I'm teaching my Revelation class. But it has a place. And what we allow the historical grammatical to do a lot of the times is overstep its boundaries. Whenever we basically sit there and say, how do I say this? When we sit there and say the New Testament writer wasn't interpreting this correctly, but he can do it because he's a New Testament writer. What we're doing is we're protecting our methodology more than we're allowing the Bible to chastise our methodology. You see the difference in that? I don't see the New Testament worshiping the Apocrypha, but I do see them using it as an authoritative part of their story. It's a part of their story. What is in their story is the question I'm asking more than anything. What is in their story? What does God use throughout their story in order to bring them to the time that we have in the Gospels? What has He used? And should we be afraid of that? And the answer is no, don't be afraid of it. Make sure, though, it's kept in its place. It's kept in its place. Is this making sense? Yeah, Adam.
One thing I think just like Bolton's argument of Jews always look to their history, it constantly shows. Well, I read a lot of stuff that was we know the Maccabean Wars happened, but these could all just be short stories, what we would think of C.S. Lewis with theology from short stories. But to me, it's really just pointing out the emphasis of their God in history and their people in history, and that their lineage is the most important. And Matthew with the lineage.
Absolutely. You're exactly right. That's one of the things I want you guys, we're going to spend a ton of time on history up front. And I know that some of it will be tempting to be boring and things of that nature, but you've got to understand their story because you're driven by your story as well. Whenever you come to right now, even when you're reflecting on what this is doing, one of the things you're wrestling with is this doesn't exactly line up with my story, where I've come from, what I've been taught, what I'm supposed to be doing, what I'm supposed to stay away from, what I'm supposed to engage in. Your story is what's rubbing up against it. And that's normal. That's good. Your story is not an accident. I truly believe in, Acts 17. God's put us in the exact place at the exact time so that we can be close to reach out and touch Him. I believe that. And the Jews believe that. And the Jews were very much driven by their story. Why do you think in Fiddler on the Roof, the point whenever the Jewish man starts screaming out, tradition, tradition, tradition. Tradition is not something that they're worshiping. It's something that guides them. It's one of the things I think is deeply dangerous in our churches when we start ripping away all tradition. That is folly. That is dangerous. Worshiping religion is just, that's a whole other issue. Good grief. That little YouTube video that's going around right now, this Jesus First Religion, not a fan. My primary reason, you never define the word religion. What are we throwing out? I'm not understanding it because I look at religion, it seems like what you're equating with the religion is the church. And I'm sorry, He has one bride. I don't really know what to do with that. I'm not saying she's pretty. She's pretty ugly. I'm a part of it. But really, we're going to put Jesus up against religion? God created a religion. Read the Old Testament. It's very cultic. Very precise. Now, if they overstep their boundaries, we need to put them back in their place. But throwing the baby out the bathwater is stupid. But I misspoke. Tradition. Tradition is not a bad thing. As a matter of fact, whenever you lose tradition, when you lose a connection to church history, to your story, you start to wander around because you don't have an identity. Your story tells you who you are. You want to know why some of our churches are so jacked up and weird? Our churches? It's because we've misunderstood what Alexander Campbell was saying about creeds and about church history. We have totally misunderstood him. Alexander Campbell knew church history backwards and forwards. And he knew the parts of it that were wrong, and he knew the parts of it that were right. And yet many of our churches, if you even mention something from church history, it's like you've just, said a four-letter word. That is foolishness. We stand in a long line of people that have struggled with understanding the incarnation and of living an incarnated life. And for us to throw that all out and to act as if that we can pioneer and plow our own way forward and not make ridiculous mistake after ridiculous mistake is simply just not to understand the way in which a story impacts us in the present. You just don't understand it. Therefore, if we become more Jewish by paying attention more to the stories of before us, I believe we'll become more balanced as a people of God. And the Apocrypha is a part of that lineage. So, I will not apologize for giving you an assignment that you have to read the entire Apocrypha. I want you to interact with it. Because those are your forefathers, along with Abraham, Isaac, and Moses. You see how this happens? Is this making sense? Are you following me? Am I saying that I am Catholic? No, I'm not Catholic. But am I saying I don't? No, actually, they're a lot smarter than what we give them credit for.